grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 264 of the Dudes and Beer podcast, now officially brought to you by PodcastCadet.com. If you're a fan of podcasting like I am, love making podcasts, looking to make a podcast, rather yourself, your family, your business, your church, or just for fun, stop on by PodcastCadet.com today. They have some great packages for you where they will set you up one-on-one with professionals, everything from branding and logo design to, you know, recording, distribution, monetization, all of it. They have great one-on-one consultation. Use the code DUDES20 on your way out the door, and you will save 20% off your entire purchase. Our guest tonight, the amazing Natasha R. Johnson of Globalizing Gender. This is a really hot-button issue, folks. I was talking with somebody earlier today about it, and they're like, wow, that is a turn on a dime for topics. And I was like, yeah, we talk about some hard conversations on Dudes and Beer. That is the idea, is to have polarizing conversations, to have conversations that we do not often talk about in society. And tonight we will be talking about the global travesty happening in your backyard. And that is the horrible, horrible human rights violation known as female genital mutilation. Natasha R. Johnson works with Globalizing Gender to get the message out there about it, to really talk about what it is, and educate people about it. So we'll be talking to her in just a moment. Before that, we do have a great clip from our good friend Michael Turber at 5x5 News. We've gotten permission to start playing some of his reports. We will soon be having him on to have an update on the Las Vegas shooting, the Mandalay Bay massacre, with Stephen Paddock. Apparently, there was a recent report from Daily Mail that talks about some possible text messages that were sent to a possible rendezvous sexually. So here's a great report from Mike Turber on that right now, folks.
I'm Mike Turber with 5x5 News, and we hear you loud and clear. In a recent news story by Daily Mail TV, a claim was made that a 29-year-old woman, who does not wish to be named but used the name Kate for their story, revealed to them exclusively that she had been a mistress of Steve Paddock for several years, and that she had been texting with Paddock up until about 2 days before the Las Vegas massacre, the largest mass shooting in United States history. I reached out to Eric Paddock, the brother of the shooter, who has been speaking with me exclusively, and showed him the text to see if they looked like something that his brother Steve would have even said. Eric stated, "I can't say yes, I can't say no. It's obvious Steve was pretty brain-puffed at the end. Under normal conditions, I'd say no way." Eric also said, "The cadence just doesn't even seem like Steve, and I haven't seen any absolute proof that it's Steve's phone doing the texting or anything." I contacted Daily Mail TV to see if we could attempt to verify the messages as well, and we are waiting for their response. What follows are the text messages claimed by Daily Mail TV to be between Kate and Steve Paddock just 2 days before the shooting at the Route 91 concert held across the street from Mandalay Bay, where Paddock was a guest. The text messages you see here are between Stephen Paddock and a person who the Daily Mail calls Kate. That's probably not her real name, but she apparently is a 29-year-old person who had a relationship with Stephen Paddock. She said she was his mistress for a few years. Before the massacre on October 1st, 2017, he started sending her some disturbing messages. That's what you see here on this video. He last contacted her in the morning hours of September 29th, 2017. Concerned about him, Kate offered to drive to Las Vegas, but he told her not to bother. She said that she shares a passion with Paddock, and that she's always friendlier than she probably should be, and that that has gotten her into trouble several times. When she originally met Paddock in Miami, she stated that she was at a bar with a friend and had gotten really drunk and was buying everyone drinks. Kate described herself and Paddock as a sloppy drunk, and she invited him back to their hotel room where they ended up having a threesome. She said that they met up a few more times and that she found out that he had a partner. But she said that he said he was planning on leaving Mary Lou Danley and that she was a gold digger and was draining his money. Then in 2016, he met up with her again, and that is when she became alarmed about his erratic behavior. She said in 2016 they had sex again, and at that time that he tried to tie her up. She said that she started getting nervous and she was trying to pull away because he had a blank stare in his eyes. She asked him to untie her and got no reaction. So she said she needed some water, and he grabbed a bottle of water and poured it in her face. She said she inhaled some of the water and started coughing. She said he seemed to snap out of whatever trance he was in and untied her. She said looking at him, she felt like she was looking into a blank stare and like he had no soul. She said that he was talking about how the world was evil and the human race was selfish and evil, and how he felt like he didn't fit in this world anymore. She stated that she knew he was becoming unhinged the days and weeks leading up to what happened, but at the time she didn't know or think that he was capable of doing what he did. She said, by looking back now and knowing what she knows, the signs were there, and she feels like she overlooked them. She said she knew there's something was wrong and that maybe he was becoming manic, but she never thought that he would be homicidal or suicidal.
Thank you so much, Mike Turber. He will be coming on here in the next week or so to talk about the updates on the Route 91 massacre, everything else that happened out there at Mandalay Bay. Stephen Paddock, I know that he is literally the only person that the brother, Eric Paddock, has spoken with privately and done interviews with about Stephen and the history behind this and leading up to it. So hopefully we will find out more from him whenever we have him on. Our guest tonight, the amazing Natasha R. Johnson, speaker at TED Talks for Globalizing Gender, a charity that works to help educate people around the world and in local communities to the travesty that is female genital mutilation. Welcome to the show, Natasha. How are you this evening?
I'm good, thank you.
Well, welcome to the show. We had a minute just before we started broadcast and everything else to kind of chat, you know, get to know each other, things like that, and to kind of go through a little bit of that again for the audience, just so they can familiarize themselves with you. Tell them a little bit about yourself, what it is that you do, and what it is that brought you to be involved with this amazing cause that, like we said before the show, it's not really something that whenever you're considering career paths in high school, junior high, that really pops to the forefront of your mind, you know, that you're going to go out and do
this.
Tell everybody how...
It's not in the yearbook.
What catalyzed you into movement in the world with this, Natasha?
Yeah, well, first, before I even answer your question, what a funky theme song.
Thank you.
I wasn't expecting such groovy tunes to welcome me in. So in answer to your question, I am an attorney, an artist, an educator, and a activist and a yoga teacher. And I use all of those disciplines to do impact work to create greater opportunities to sort of eliminate gender-based violence locally and domestically. So that's what we do, and that's what our mission is, to create a gender-just world. And we do that through advocacy, capacity building, education, art, and wellness. And so in answer to your question specifically around female genital mutilation and cutting, and I use both those terms, mutilation and cutting, because to be honest, in most communities where this practice occurs, most community members don't use either of those terms. So even in using them, we get that the terminology has been westernized. Mm. But I use them because it really just depends on the nomenclature that the folks that I'm working with and on behalf of use. And if they identify the practice as a cutting or as tradition, then that's what I call it. And if they consider it mutilation and that title is occurred to them, then that's how I call it. But for our conversation, I'll just say FGMC to keep it short. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. We love our acronyms and alphabets here on the show.
Okay, so, good. So we'll go through a lot of them here.
Yeah. And, you know,
because there are a good number of them.
It really is, I think, a misunderstood thing and something that's really just not understood, Natasha. Even the person that I was discussing this with earlier was like, what is that? Like, you know, what, like, wow.
Yeah.
A shocking topic, of course, and we talk a lot about those things. We're supposed to talk about these things in society's folks. It's what betters us as human beings is to have these hard, rough conversations. Because you got into culture for a minute, and that's what I had to kind of explain to her. Let's go a little bit into where the root of some of this comes from and how it translates into modern society and even into people's neighborhoods and backyards right here in America, because this is not just a global issue.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, FGMC is a 1,000-year-old practice. It dates back well before most of us can probably even document. It's been practiced all throughout the world. It's not new to the United States, but it is definitely much more prominent now. FGMC has been practiced in a host of different countries and communities. It's not religiously based at all, nor is it medically based. It has no medical benefits. Nor any religious ones under any sort of auspices. But in a good number of communities, there will be folks who say that the practice endures because of tradition, because of religion, because of domicility, because it's a way for women to move forward in particular communities. It's practiced differently in different communities and at different times. But in short, FGMC is either the cutting or the complete removal of the clitoris and or the labia minora or labia majoras. And that practice happens, depending on the community, at some point, normally between the ages of 6 months, you're 6 months old to anywhere between right before marriage, which could be anywhere from 13 years old and upwards. But it happens at different times, and the practices are quite different and the types are different depending on the community and where it happens. If we were talking U.S. specific, in the U.S., if we're talking about our backyards, there are about 500,000 women and girls impacted by FGMC here. A good Wow. number of those women are mostly coming from immigrant communities, but it's important to note that FGMC was covered by Blue Cross Blue Shield in the U.S. up until 1977 to sort of reduce women's hysteria. It's not an unknown practice to the U.S.
And that's just it. That's something that we've talked about on this show before, that not many people realize that until like 1978, there were still eugenics laws in most states where if you were above a certain, under a certain IQ, you were not allowed to breed, like all kinds of stuff. Like these are recent topics, folks, that for some reason have just slipped through the cracks on us.
I mean, in New York, which is where I'm at, and up until 1984, it wasn't illegal to – marital rape wasn't illegal.
Wow. And, you know, it's just phenomenal that, like I said, these are all such recent practices. And like you said, this is the FGMC is done typically and frequently under the guise of religion, tribal belief, things like that. But not really the case. And like you said, millions of cases in the United States. Like my jaw dropped when I read that the other day. Because my God, there's always that fact of kind of like male rape cases where you're like, wow, if the numbers are that, imagine how many go unreported. Imagine how many cases
and that's
the women
here. There are lots of folks who actually aren't reporting.
Exactly. and how many of the cases are found by accident through maybe some sort of medical exam, things like that. Not necessarily as somebody coming forward and trying to break from that community and break from that literal psychological bond, that you were trying to create with somebody and do to somebody for the rest of their life.
Well, yeah, I mean, you've spoken to a couple of different nuances that make the issue of FGMC really nuanced and complicated. It is partly, I think, why some folks like feel like it's a little too icky, for lack of a better word, to step into and thinking about how to grab some agency around it and step into it and give folks some support. But one of those reasons is because FGMC is normally organized by family members and community members. And so it gets really icky and nuanced when the, you know, the actor may be dad or grandma. And so it can be a little icky, one, for someone to come forward and ask for help, and two, for you to see that person as a wrongdoer, just as if it was an issue of, you know, a parent who had committed sexual assault or, you know, some sort of date rape. It's, you know, those issues get a little bit more nuanced when they're those familial and psychosocial relationships that create those kinds of bonds.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the other issues is that, you know, I think this is often less said often than it needs to be, which is that it's just about women and it's about women's bodies. And folks don't like to talk about that, particularly when most of the folks who are doing the legislating are not women or not people with women's bodies. And so it makes it a distant issue to think about how to step in to advocate really powerfully on behalf of those folks. And when there's no space for that, it makes it harder for someone to come forward, particularly when the issue often gets misunderstood and is not highly recognized. And depending on when that person may have been impacted and may have been cut, they may not actually even know that their bodies are modified.
That's right.
Right. Until, as you mentioned, they may end up having to go to a doctor for another issue or an issue that actually might be a symptom of FGMC that they're actually not even aware of, which happens really often, particularly for lots of my teenage clients who are just stepping into, you know, puberty or womanhood, and now they're recognizing that, you know, their bodies are doing things a little bit differently than maybe their friends at school.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And, you know, that's just it. That's why I put that phrase in there a while ago, discovered accidentally, you know, because a lot of these things do get found out, like once gym class starts happening, things like that, you know, and you're changing in front of people and you start seeing some of the behavioral differences, that kind of stuff. So to know that there are that many out there that are that young, like you said, this is something that is done typically that, kind of like, I guess, under the guise of a bris and right up around the same age, you know.
Yeah.
Very, very
young. It can start that early. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, most definitely.
You know, I did a workshop once here in Brooklyn with some teenagers and preteens, nice mix of genders in the room. And when we started talking about how they could be helpful to, you know, friends who might be experiencing FGMC, a lot of the boys suddenly asked about male circumcision.
Yeah.
And they asked, you know, about similarities and differences, which is a natural place to go when you're thinking about the world of these issues. And in having that conversation with them to give them some agency around it, we started to talk about what happens with male circumcision. And a lot of the boys suddenly realized that they may have already been circumcised.
Yeah.
And they immediately raised their hands. Eyes were wide as you can possibly imagine. And they're like, why would someone do that to me? And I said, well, you know, it's a good question. I don't know. I said, but, you know, it's I showed them what a circumcised penis looks like. Sure. And I showed them what an uncircumcised one looks like. And I said, you know, this might be a great opportunity for you to have a really powerful conversation with your parents around choice and around body autonomy.
Yeah.
Because that's all anybody wants.
Yep. Yeah,
and that's really what I've been advocating for on behalf of folks who experience FGMC.
And that's what I love is the fact that you are treating this as a human rights violation, which it absolutely is when you're talking about it in these circumstances. It's horrifying to know that you have permanently altered that for a young lady. You have permanently changed the way that their body responds for the rest of their life.
I mean, the UN declared FGMC a human rights violation in 2018.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. is not a signatory to many of the UN protocols, so that doesn't necessarily give us a place to step into powerfully around that. In 2016. And in 2018, we lost a federal case, in Michigan that made it constitutional, to cut girls here in the United States. And it's been deferred now to a state's rights matter as opposed to a federal issue.
Wow.
Which essentially means that the federal government has become mute on the issue.
Yeah.
And, so what that means is that each state has to really sort of step in and say what they want to happen to their women and girl citizens around this issue. And that's been, you know, a little bit of a Pandora's box because each state has a very different response to it. And so really our work at Globalizing Gender is one to raise awareness about this issue and to raise awareness about it very responsibly, but also to really start to reframe this issue as a human rights issue, as you mentioned, but not as simply an immigrant rights issue or a women's rights issue or a girls' rights issue. But it is a public health issue overall that has greater impact for all of us. And so that's the other thing that we've been really working ardently around doing. And in New York specifically, we've been working to create really some pilots and test cases that, if successful, will hopefully be able to be replicated throughout different jurisdictions throughout the country. Because up until now, our response has been pretty full and pretty mute. And this will give us an opportunity to step into a much larger global community and global response around this issue.
Well, and speaking of the global response and community response, exactly how are y'all going about, like I was saying before the show, mm-hmm. one of our regular guests, and you will be added to our Causes We Believe In page on the Dudes and Beer website, by the way.
Because awesome.
This
Thank
is
you.
Like this is something that we believe we need to raise awareness about. We need to try and explain to people what is actively going on in the world around us. And it's been interesting to see our audience's response and growing response, mm-hmm. Especially on Facebook. Whenever myself or Billy Joe Kane from Radical Empathy Education Foundation post things about human trafficking, now it mm-hmm. actively sparks community conversation, like immediately, whereas before it sat
yeah.
there. And it's nice to know that it took a little time to expose them to the topic, but once they were there and once they heard the stories and once they saw what he was trying to do to change things, they welcomed the message in, you know. And mm-hmm. to know that you're out there doing this, we want to try and welcome that message in to our community as well.
Thank you. That's what we're looking for.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say. What can people do, and what are you doing actively right now? Because like we're saying, this is not just an international issue going on. This is happening in your backyard, people. Guaranteed, much like human trafficking, this is happening in your town, in your community. What are y'all doing to reach out to local communities, mm-hmm. To, like you said, working with youth, everything like that. What are some of the programs that
yeah.
y'all are implementing right now to do that?
Well, you know, this work doesn't get done alone. It has to get done in community and in collaboration, you know, because I think big work requires big people. So Globalizing Gender, along with a host of other organizations, some local, meaning here in New York, and others nationally and even some globally, we work in coordination and partnership, meaning that we share information, we share tools, we share resources, we share our successes, we also share our breakdowns and our failures when things don't work, and really give each other the opportunity to really sort of have a sort of brainstorming around what are the next steps and what's best and what's most appropriate. And that's really because it's a nuanced issue, and what happens with one community and in one area may be a really good guide, but it may not be specific enough to how the issues are manifesting in another community. And that may just be because of geographics or because of community. For instance, if I were working with colleagues in Minnesota, they have a much larger Somali and Ethiopian community in the Midwest as opposed to here, even here in New York, which tends to have a much larger West African and South Asian community group.
Yeah.
So because of that, some of the nuances and the ways in which we do the work will change a little bit. But more specifically, in answer to your question, some of the things that we're doing. So in 2018, we had the first awareness raising march here in New York City, and we walked 5 miles from City Hall and invited folks from all 5 boroughs to raise awareness about this issue. We had a concert, we had flyers, we had tabling, we had individuals who've experienced this issue and survived speak and talk to others. And it was really multidimensional and multidisciplinary, and that's the important piece. So we had folks from FBI, USCIS, NYPD, the DA's offices, health and hospitals, and a host of community-based organizations that are working within the communities throughout New York City and throughout the country that work directly with community members who are impacted by this issue. And right after that, we then had our first hearing with City Council to start to look at, you know, where that might be an opportunity for them to step in and get some oversight around this issue, particularly because, as you mentioned earlier, even though the numbers are astounding now, we still know that they're outdated and that they're inaccurate.
Yeah.
And so it's really going to be necessary for all of us, if thinking about any of our next strategies and next approaches, to really have our numbers right, or at least to have them a lot closer to what's really happening on the ground, because then we'll be able to really start to think about how we direct our resources, how we direct our energies, how we direct our funding, and how we direct our bodies, our personnel, to sort of really address these issues. So we had that hearing, and it was the first that the New York City has ever had on this issue. And then after that, we've been working in coordination to develop a task force that will be the first of its kind in the country that will be responsible at looking at some of these issues that come up with respect to female genital mutilation and cutting here in New York City. So right now we have legislation that's pending in City Council that will create the sort of mechanism for where the task force will live. And it would live in one of the mayor's offices. However, we've gotten slowed down because of the coronavirus.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure that's happening with most folks,
yeah.
No matter what you're working on right now. And so it was supposed to be ratified by the middle of March, but that definitely hasn't happened. So that's where we are right now. And if we're able to move forward and get that legislation ratified, we'll have a legal mechanism in which the city will now be responsible, sort of start to address this issue and start to build some manpower there, some person power there, and some resources. And the resources would look multidimensional, just like our efforts with raising awareness, because it's an issue that impacts all of those disciplines. So we want to have all of those people involved, and they've been involved so far in the sort of creation of legislation and the advocacy around it, and we want to keep them involved in developing what the meat and potatoes of the actual legislation and the subsequent pieces of legislation will be, to sort of have it really live into fruition and have it really make sense for the people, at least here in New York City.
Yeah.
It's in the New York metropolitan area. Of that 500,000, there are about 65,000 women and girls that are impacted.
Wow.
So we're one of the largest in the country.
Wow. And granted, one of the largest cultural mixing pots as well.
Whenever
it comes to, and not that we aren't saying that it doesn't happen here in America, but like we're saying, it's frequently tied to culture.
Absolutely.
Traditionally.
All kinds of cultures. You know,
yeah.
What I didn't say earlier, when we were talking about, you know, just the reframing of this issue and how to be responsible around it, is that not only is FGMC a very old and sort of anciently practiced phenomenon, but it also was prominent here in the U.S. well before a lot of these sort of immigrant communities moved here and sort of added to that those numbers. There were a good number of sort of I would say fundamentalist religious communities, particularly in the Midwest, that practice a myriad forms of FGMC. And for them, they have it also tied to religious auspices. But again, as I mentioned before, no matter what community it is, there aren't any sort of religious underpinnings. There's no religious text that supports the practice.
Oh, no. No, none whatsoever. So, nowhere does it say that in Old English or Hebrew or
in anything,
in Arabic,
in
or,
any of them.
Yeah, not a single one. I've read most of them. I don't remember that being. I'm pretty sure I'd have highlighted that somewhere. So yeah, it really is something that, like we're saying, is such a cultural issue, and tied to that, that it's hard to infiltrate that community and to get that message across. What have been some of the ways that, because you're talking about the task force right now, I don't want to get into like y'all strategies if you can't give it away, things like that, but what are some of the ways that y'all are empowering officers in this task force to be able to identify people in communities that have been affected by
this? Yeah, so the good thing is that a lot of the folks who are already on the, and right now our task force really is the beginnings of what will hopefully live into a task force. Right now we're just a bunch of concerned people that do this work and have been working with this with these communities for a very long time in multiple ways. And we've joined together to really think about how to do it differently and do it smartly. But, you know, I think what we're committed to doing is helping the city build out a nuanced response the same way that they've been able to do so with survivors of domestic violence, and the same way that they've been able to do with survivors of human trafficking, and the same ways that they've been able to do with survivors of sexual assault. Because they each involve, those are sister issues oftentimes, and sometimes they even serve as gateways to each other, depending on the issues, to each other. And so what we've been looking at is how to actually create counter criminal responses to FGMC in New York. And when I say counter criminal, that means right now in New York, FGMC and vacation cutting, which is the practice of sending girls to their families' home countries during summer, winter, or spring break to get cut instead, which also happens here. Both of those practices are illegal in New York City, at least. Having them just be illegal without there being other resources available doesn't give someone who is either being threatened with FGMC or might be primed to experience the practice very soon any place else to step into any sort of agency or support. Because the likelihood is that she will probably be raising eyebrows on family members that are either nuclear, like directly in her home, or extended. And so the possibilities, if we just leave things as they are, is that those individuals and persons would either possibly be arrested, depending on their immigration status, they could be deported potentially, and depending on her age and what other resources are available to her family, she may end up in foster care. So that can't be a real answer for someone who's looking to seek recourse and body autonomy. And so part of our job will be to create counter criminal opportunities and resources that would be available to individuals and families who are experiencing FGMC. What that looks like, I'm not exactly 100% sure yet, because we'll be in the creation of it. You know, the beauty and the hard place around doing something that's new is that you don't have a blueprint.
Yeah.
And because this hasn't been done in the U.S. before, we don't have a model. We have our experience. We have our knowledge base of the communities that we're working on behalf of. We have their insight and their contributions because we talk to them and ask them. And then we really are going to be in the collective creation of figuring out what it's going to look like and what it's going to sound like, knowing that we'll make some mistakes along the way. But that the goal is to really create opportunities and options and resources and choice for individuals who are experiencing that. So I do know that one of the major pieces will be to, create counter criminal opportunities. Another will be to provide family interventions for families who are experiencing FGMC. Just because a family may have a girl who is going to, or who's organizing for a young woman to be cut, they may not necessarily actually always want their daughters to be cut.
That's right.
That pressure may be coming from other family members. It may be coming from elders, from community elders. There's a lot of other places or entities where that pressure can be coming from. And so when appropriate and when we can, we want to also be able to make these powerful family interventions to give families families other options so that they can maybe develop alternatives to cutting and not necessarily have to cut their daughters. That's a practice that's worked really, really well in some other environments and some other countries. And while we're not exactly set up the same way, we want to think about how we can, again, model some of those practices when appropriate. So we want to think about what that would look like here as well within our task force. Some of the other things that we've been looking to do is to create psychosocial assistance and psychosocial services for families and particularly for the girls who are experiencing FGMC or who are at threat of experiencing it. And also gynecological services that are specific to those who are experiencing FGMC. And particularly in that vein, also rehabilitated gynecological services when appropriate, which won't be the case with everybody, but can be the case with some of them. And so when necessary and when appropriate and when available, we want to be able to offer that as well.
Yeah.
So without going into too much detail, those are some of the major areas that we want to work on. We also want to do community awareness trainings, and that doesn't only mean with the community members and neighborhood folks. We're also talking about the major city stakeholders, so yeah. Department of Education,
that's right.
Because those are folks who come into contact with young people all the time. We're talking about DOH and MOH, which is our Department of Health and Mental Health. Those are our, you know, that's our medical body of folks that we want to have armed with this information. So as you mentioned, so when folks who are showing up at doctors' offices for theoretically indirect FGMC reasons, they still will be able to recognize these cases and be able to provide them with necessary resources when available. And we also are wanting to train ACS, which is our Administration for Children's Services, because they come into contact with these families pretty often as well. So those are some of the other three arms in addition to our good friends in NYPD. So those are some of the major forums that we also want to make sure are involved in that community awareness training.
The fact that y'all have brought this onto the radar, like you said, NYPD, it's absolutely awesome that y'all have gotten their attention on this. Cause I know it took radical empathy a while to get a little bit of traction with them and to make them understand that like this was an issue. This was something you need to look into and something that you need to train your officers and like you're saying, mental health officers whenever they step into a situation of domestic violence, whenever they step into a situation of child neglect, anything like that where this becomes a part of it, they've got to know how to deal with it.
And it's really for them as well, right? Because they're already professionals. They have a level of expertise. And what we want to do is make sure that we're working in collaboration with them and that they feel ever more armed and ever more responsible and more prepared to handle these issues.
Precisely.
Right? So this is really about us thinking about how do we sort of use the strengths and benefits of each of our different arms of our agencies so that we can collectively work to best serve these communities, right? So we're definitely not working in a way in which we're divisive or, identifying oversights or blind spots but in the ways in which they've worked in the past, but moreover to think about if this hasn't been something that's been in your purview up until now, now that it is, we want to make sure that you're really well armed really well resourced to be able to handle it. Because the likelihood is that you've seen it already, but you actually weren't really aware that it was present for you in that way.
Yeah.
And now that you know it, now we want to make sure that you're armed and ready to deal with it next time you see it.
Yeah, it really is more about providing them additional tools in their toolkit for whenever they're out in the field. New means by which to diagnose things, to spot things, to open the conversation about things. Because like you're saying, they are absolutely trained professionals. They just need to know what to look for. There's just a different tweak, and a different tool set that they need to be aware of. And the fact that you guys are stepping into communities, working with local law enforcement, working with local mental health authorities in this capacity is beautiful. And I hope that more communities really start to raise their eyes to this situation because it's, like I said, it's something that woefully most people are not familiar with. I am familiar with it through the years of youth ministry work that I did. and the numerous people that we would have come speak to youth, or that we would see speak at youth conferences for 3 days, or, you know, things like that, where it's like you go to a breakout room and you're learning about some kind of social impact situation like this, or Amnesty International, that kind of stuff. And that was my first real exposure to it.
That's a new one for me. Most people tell me they hear about it in anthropology class.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's just it. You know, maybe you hear about it on something like Taboo from the National Geographic Channel, something like that. You know, along the lines of scarification, which is practiced by numerous African cultures as rites of passage, that kind of stuff. And that's like we were saying, culturally, what most people do it under the guise of as a rite of passage, some sort of religious thing. But nowhere in any religious text around the world or belief is that the case. So it's, you know, what have y'all found through your work is some of the reasoning behind this for people that have recovered, people that have kind of, you know, I guess come out of the cult mentality, you know?
You know, it's a mixed bag. I am very fortunate that, the folks that, I work on behalf of are some of the bravest and most powerful people I've ever met. And so whenever, there's a breakdown and the ideas and strategies and policies that we're working on around this issue or some of the other sister issues that we work on at Globalizing Gender, I'm constantly reminded of the bravery of the clients and the women and girls and boys also that I work on behalf of. And I get right back on the court because they've endured a heck of a lot more than I have in respect to these issues. So, you know, one disappointment today won't be the death knell for these greater causes. So with that being said, for lots of the folks who I know who have experienced this practice, a good number of them are advocates for others to have choice and agency over their own bodies. There are definitely people who've experienced this practice who have shared with me that it was a practice that they wanted to endure and engage in. And as I would say with anybody else, you have complete choice and agency over your own body. I think for me, and when I say me, I'm talking about the work here at Globalizing Gender, our job is just to create the opportunities that individuals have choice. And not only do they have choice, but they're also well informed with all of the information so that whenever they do make a decision, they're making an informed one that hopefully isn't coming from a place of duress or from a place of coercion. But for the folks who I have worked with, a good number of them are advocates for others to have choice, but a good number of them are even more ardent and want this practice eliminated. But they also live these very vibrant lives where FGMC is not the totality of who they are or the totality of their experiences. And for many of them, it's one of many things and one of many characteristics that make them who they are. And so because of that, because of their diversity and their magnanimous personalities, I'm regularly humbled and reminded of that in all of the work that I do on their behalf and on behalf of others daily.
Yeah, because, I mean, you have to really kind of be able to, I guess, step behind their shoes. There's no way that you can really step into their shoes, but you can definitely walk behind their shoes and be really close in proximity to see what the wake is, what the effect is, what the family effect is with people around them, you know, because there's, with anything like that, there is a ripple effect with the family. Like you were saying, it may not necessarily be the case that the mother wanted this to happen to her daughter. You know, and it's something that is just carried on and carried on. And it's literally a point of normalization, you know, where.
In many communities, it's something that's not discussed and it's not talked about, even mother to daughter or, you know, daughter to grandmother, aunt to niece and cousin to cousin and sister to sister. It's just something that happens and it's expected to happen. And oftentimes there's no further communication about it afterwards, including what happens to you physically and emotionally and psychosocially. And so it can definitely have this ripple effect, as you said, and have long-term impact. And that's really why our work here is to also create that, those family interventions and that psychosocial assistance, so that the families themselves can also start to think about building in and incorporating tools so that they can start to repair some of those ruptures.
Yeah, because it really is about providing people the means by which to assist themselves and help themselves and lift themselves up in this situation. And the work that y'all are doing is literally, like you were saying, so vast. It's gotta almost work in your favor with the shock factor whenever you approach lawmakers, things like that, because this is like I'm saying, it's something that most people are not aware is happening. Like, maybe they heard something cursorily, like we were saying, in a documentary somewhere at some point, but to know it is still going on, that it's still pervasive, that it is still happening right here in America, in not only immigrant cultures but localized culture as well.
I don't know if that shock value helped initially. I think it was a hard road to choke for people. It was a harder pill to swallow.
Okay.
That it was so domestic.
Wow. All right. Because to me, I think that was the case initially. Yeah, and I could definitely, I guess, see that where it's one of those that, like, no way.
Like, right, not us.
You know?
Not us, too.
But yeah. And even one of those internationally where it's like, no, it can't be that number. It can't be that many. And I was recently talking with my wife about some statistics on stuff that, you know, she was like, oh, that it can't be that globally. I'm like, you know, let's take a look at the like 3.6 billion people in the world. You know, let's start doing the simple bar math here and start separating it out. That could very likely be the number. And then we started looking it up for and it was like, yep, that's the number. Look at that. It seems like an extraordinary...
Yeah, globally it's a little bit more than a million.
Yeah. But even still, when you start doing that math, you know, you're looking at like a percent. And when you're talking about 1%, that's like, my God. It's just mind-numbing to know that percentage globally still exists of something like this going on.
And because it's not something that's discussed, you know, I was doing a right before Corona, my last presentation before the rest of them got canceled. I'm not upset. Anyway.
I do corporate AV for a living. I'm not hating. Go ahead, Corona. Do your thing, man. Just go away quick.
Listen, I'm here for it. I'm in the house. I'm following all the rules. I totally get it. But at one of the last presentations, this young woman, I mean, and she was just curious. And she said, you know, I don't get it. She's like, I don't get why, you know, this issue is so prevalent and why it's still happening. And I said to her, I said, how many, you know, the room again, a nice mix of genders. And I said, how many folks in here that have a vagina walk around and talk to people about your vagina?
Yeah. Yeah. Precisely.
No one raised their hand.
Yeah.
So I said, that's the point.
Well, and, you know, it, just to get into that personal realm real quick, you know, it is the fact that labiaplasty, things like that have skyrocketed. Yeah. Over the last many years, over body shaming and things like that, because women are literally sold this gender identity of what they're supposed to look like. And when they find out that they're like a little bit different, who cares? Who cares?
But I have to say, if it wasn't for that pressure, unfortunately, we wouldn't have some of the science that we need to actually help folks who experience FGMC and might be candidates for rehabilitative surgeries.
Yes.
So because of because of that pressure, and actually because of the trans community, yes, there's been a lot of work done and a lot of science that's been made available over the past like 15 years that wasn't there before.
Well,
so there's a whole generation of women and girls now who might have options to live a very different life than their mothers or grandmothers ever could have imagined.
And fruitful, productive life sexually and, you know, enjoyably,
yeah,
things like that. That's just it. It really is about, this is one of those situations where you were talking about the whole patient, not just the symptom.
Mm-hmm.
You're really trying to treat the whole patient and restore a person, to a sense of identity. And we've got about 10 minutes left. Let's spend the last few minutes talking about, because, you know, it's a heavy topic. It's a heavy topic. I want to have you on again because it is definitely one, like I said, that I want to bring more light to. But here in the last few minutes, let's talk about a few of the rays of hope, like what you're talking about, the surgical procedures, the new science, things. If there are women out there, if there are family members of women out there that have been stricken with this, that have been hit with this, what can they do? What are their options that are out there right now to seek help, to seek healing?
So there are a small team of amazing gynecologists, and I really do mean small. There are about 10 of them around the country that have been working on these issues specifically around female genital mutilation and cutting. And they are an amazing team of people that look at these issues on a daily basis and are always thinking about how to make things a little bit different and a little bit better for folks who are experiencing this through science. And so depending on where those folks are, in the listening audience, we'd love to, if necessary, put those folks in touch with them so that they can start to at least be in conversation around creating options and opportunities, or at minimum, at least know what those options and opportunities might be. And then with respect to, the whole self, as you mentioned, I strongly encourage folks to start to seek psychosocial services if they aren't already having them. September to December of last year, myself and two other organizations led a small pilot in Harlem, providing gynecological and psychosocial services to women and girls in the northern Manhattan and northern Bronx area who were experiencing FGMC. And in one of those opportunities, we were able to create a weekly support group where they got to gather once a week and just to share and talk to each other. I know that they were not just the only lone person and lone survivor in a room in a vast room filled with other people, where they got to feel, where they didn't have to feel different anymore. I strongly encourage folks that if they aren't already engaged in some sort of psychosocial support or some sort of wellness initiative to please think about how to step into them. I mentioned that I'm also a yoga teacher, and part of the reason why I teach yoga is because I've been very curious about how the body releases trauma. Mm. And I say that, and I'm sort of also laughing at myself hypocritically because I right now have not a pinched nerve, but a really tight muscle that's been making me cry the past 2 days in my shoulder. And so I'm very curious about how to release that as well, but how to sort of release trauma from the body. And in thinking about acts of female genital mutilation and cutting and other forms of gender-based violence, that trauma often lives on in our bodies and can just start to
absolutely
add and gather and have such profound weight. And so I've been looking at yoga as a tool, again, to add to that toolkit that we've been talking about, to sort of think about how to decouple one's body from that trauma that they may have experienced. And so I've been teaching yoga here in New York City at domestic violence shelters and in my own community just for free, just to give people another option to step into, to think about how they can actually be in control of how to sort of decouple themselves from whatever trauma they may have experienced. And then also just think about, what does it mean to have a powerful conversation with people? Just ask people how they're doing and what they're dealing with. The likelihood is that we all know someone or someone that have experienced either this issue or one of the other ones, the other similar sister issues that we've been talking about this evening. And so oftentimes when folks know that they're not alone and they're not going to be judged and be prejudiced, they're much more willing to step into sharing and letting you know what they're up to. And if we could all just be that person for someone else, that makes a huge difference. And, as we were talking, you and I, Chris, before we got on the air, maybe that's something that people see more available to them now in the space of Corona, where they didn't see that before.
That
opportunity to just be neighborly and be present with the people around you and not to ignore them.
And
if you can do that for someone, you might be able to make a powerful difference and a powerful intervention for someone.
I do not have my applause button ready. And it makes me sad because I have been saying that for the last
for the last
three episodes is, my God, if coronavirus teaches us anything, people, let's hope that it brings us back to a point of empathy. Let's hope that it brings us back to a point where we actively care about the person across the fence from us, you know. I would challenge most people right now, even if you live in an apartment, look at your hands and try to name that many neighbors just on one hand. Just look at your right hand. See if you can name five neighbors. Like, these are the people that are supposed to care for you if there's an emergency. Yeah, you know, it can, exactly. Look at how long it took. It's like trying to remember a phone number nowadays. Good luck.
Yeah. Oh my God, don't do that.
Our brains used to be computers, you know, like I had 28 numbers memorized back in the day. Now it's like, I don't know. Hold on. What's my mom's phone number?
I forget my own.
Like, it's horrifying. Thank God I know my wife's, because man, if I was ever arrested, you know.
But good one. Good on you, Chris.
But it's literally the case of we have lost so much empathy for each other societally, and how our lives impact each other, and how to have that true common heart of care just for somebody as a human being. You don't have to know them. You don't have to know them to listen, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
and that's it. That's the piece there. Like, you don't have to be an immigrant to care about this. You don't have to be a woman or a girl. No. You just have to be a human that's invested in the fact that people get to have freedom over their bodies.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's the place to start with all of this.
Precisely. Precisely. Well, Natasha, thank you so much for taking the time in the last minute here. Please do let everybody know where they can go to find out more about FGMC, where they can get involved, what they can do, and what they can do about donating to Globalizing Gender, to becoming part of this movement.
Yeah, we need you. I'm assuming you're already an ambassador because I've talked to you for an hour, so you're hired.
Oh, I'm here.
But we want everybody to be an ambassador as well. So you can reach us at www.globalizinggender.org. That's all one word, www.globalizinggender.org. And the answer to all of your questions will be there.
Fantastic. That is so great. Thank you so much for taking the time. Like I said, I love the fact that, number one of my wife's family members was shocked by something that I was talking about tonight, was literally taken aback, like, whoa, like, she's known me for more than a decade. Are you really surprised by now at any conversation I am willing to have in the world? So it was one of those, like, good, I'm glad somebody is shocked by this. People should be shocked
by this.
Well, that's
great that you keep occurring to her as new.
It's like,
good job on you.
You know, we've got to bring issues like this to light, folks. We've got to walk through the world with open eyes and open hearts. We can no longer have a society that is removed from each other, that is removed from knowing our impact on one another and what we can do for each other by literally just being there to listen. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, the amazing Tasha R. Johnson with Globalizing Gender, thank you so much for taking the time this evening. Please do hold the line while we close things out, Natasha. While you are online checking out Globalizing Gender, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. That is where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find all of the causes that we care about, like Globalizing Gender, like Righteous Causes, Inc., like Good Counsel, Inc., you know, like the Law Office of J.L. Carpenter, Reef, everything else. While you're on the Dudes and Beer site, make sure to check out our new videos page. It's got all the awesome YouTube channels from our guests like Gray Scott, the futurist, transhumanist and presidential candidate, Zoltan Istvan, 5x5 News, Sev Talk, all that great stuff. Graham Phillips. Until next time, everybody, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and if you can't be good at it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.